Keep cool this summer when you shop ceiling fans at Menards. Upgrade your space with a quick install ceiling fan from Patriot Lighting. They're loaded with extra features that will make your ceiling fan install a breeze. Plus, they reduce energy costs, helping you save time and money. Save big on our great selection of ceiling fans. Plus, check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now. Save big money at Menards.
I don't really like listening to you. I don't like the sounds you're making. But I love your smile.
This is the Extra Hot Great Podcast, episode 625 for the week of July 27th, 2026. I am mandatory Costco snack run David T. Cole, and I'm here with duty agent Sarah D. Bunting.
Sorry, you're stuck with me.
Loose candy corn Tar Ariano.
What did you call me?
And miracle knockout serum Tim Grierson.
Yay, time to drug Rob Delaney.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of Extra Hot Great. Thanks for coming along with us. Before we get into our lead topic, a little bit of pod business. We have reached another milestone on our club campaign, which means this for the Friday show. One, everybody gets to pick a new sticker. So that'll be crowdsourced. We're taking in your suggestions right now. We'll pick five or so of our favorite ones, put them up for a poll in the weeks ahead. And then we will make that sticker for club members. And if they want it, they just got to give us our mailing address and say, I want that sticker. And we'll send it to them. So thank you so much for your help on that. And then the other perk alongside that is listener game time. So finally, game time will be part of our Friday show. And then you, dear listeners, will be the contestants. The way we're going to work it is we're going to find three people to play all the games for that month so that we can record them all in one big batch and save my sanity and my schedule. So that form is also up. You can sign up right now. Put your hat into the ring. These links are in your Friday show notes. So look for them on Friday because we don't want the riffraff that don't, you know, that are on the club to start signing up for listener game times. That way lies madness. So look for that on Friday's show and then join us and be a contestant. ExtraHotGreat.com/club is the place to learn more and to sign up. You can join on Patreon or you can join directly on Apple. Audio only perks on Apple.
Thank you, Dave. And thank you, listeners who got us here. And thank you to everyone who's going to hear this and decide now is finally the time for me to join. We welcome you and we love you. For now, he is the senior U.S. critic for Screen International. His writing appears frequently in the Los Angeles Times and Rolling Stone. He is the co-host of the film podcast Grierson and Leach, and his most recent book is This Is How You Make a Movie. It's Tim Grierson. Welcome, Tim.
When you look at your book title, do you do it like the song, This Is How We Make a Movie? Because I just did.
Yeah, I should have called you, Dave, for promotion of the book. I need a jingle, and Dave, you could have given me one.
All I want to do is stand behind you whenever the book comes up. I want to be the hype man just for the title of the book.
I could have used a hype man. I appreciate that, Dave. Thank you all for having me back on. I always love being here.
Thank you for being here. We are talking about Furious. Moments into the premiere episode cold open, a young woman, the closed captions called Catherine, even though that's almost certainly not her real name. Character is played by Lola Pettigrew. Catherine uses fentanyl to kill a man in his handsome Brooklyn brownstone. Before long, Alice Black, Emmy Rossum, is called to the crime scene by Detective Danny Kelly, Scoot McNairy. The two used to work together before Alice left the NYPD to start over from the bottom as an FBI agent. Nearly everyone above them is eager to rule the guy's death an accidental suicide because his father is a renowned billionaire philanthropist. But Alice and Danny think there's more to the case. As Alice enlists the interest of Nora Washington, Quincy Tyler Bernstein, the sex crimes unit head Alice eventually wants to work for, the outlines of the case start to become more clear. The show was inspired by the 1987 film Black Widow, not the Scarlett Johansson one, written by Ron Bass. For that reason, he is an EP on this show, which was created by Elizabeth Merriweather of New Girl and The Dropout fame. Three episodes dropped on Hulu July 27th. We got access to the whole 8-episode season, but we will be careful about spoilers. Let's do the Chen check-in. Tim, should our listeners watch Furious?
I'm very much on the fence. I think people need to go in with lowered expectations.
Sarah?
Yes, I think they should.
Dave?
I was also on the fence on this one, mostly because of the ever-present, should have this been a movie question, because it seemed like it was getting drawn out for me. What I've seen was competently done, and I found things to enjoy about it, but I'm also like, 8 hours of this? Really?
Darn. Yeah. I did end up watching all of it. I thought it started stronger than it ended. And yes, the ever-present movie question is ever-present here as well. Mm-hmm. Let's get into it.
I feel
it.
Like that should be part of the new ecosystem of television reviews, you know, next to your star rating or however you want to do it. Movie to TV spectrum. Where should have this been?
Yeah. Yes.
Comes up a lot.
I mean, but the problem is that I'm not telling Tim anything. He doesn't know. No one makes movies at this middle brow level anymore. Right. And when you do get one that's like Conclave, for example, very different subject matter, but same brow level, in my opinion, it's like everyone goes nuts forgetting that there used to be like 6 movies of this caliber opening in a weekend. But
all right. So we'll do a matrix with axes and we've got brow levels where we put pictures of brows that are high or low. And, and then the other one, we've got TV to movie.
Mm-hmm.
Great. Perfect. Great. All we need is 10 times more space for our TV reviews and we're all set.
And every publication is dying to give more space to critics here in the year 2026. Mm-hmm. Let's actually get into it. I hadn't seen the movie before. I watched it this weekend. The story there is the titular Black Widow, Catherine, or whatever her real name is, played by Teresa Russell, targets much older rich guys, marries them, then fatally poisons them to inherit all their money. And Deborah Winger plays Alex, who works for the Justice Department, becomes convinced there's a connection between seemingly unrelated deaths, and surprise, she's right. So about halfway through the movie, she has this conversation with her boss, who's played by a still dark-haired Terry O'Quinn. Let's hear that clip, Dave.
Oh. Well, you figure you know her, huh? Why she does it? Tell me.
When I was a kid, my father... I told you this story, though, didn't I? My dad had quite a temper. He used to take off after me with this spatula, you know, stainless steel pancake turner. Man, that thing stung like hell. One of these times, I don't even remember what I did. He chased me down the hall and he got me into my bedroom. And he was beating the crap out of me.
Man.
And he stood up, keeled over and died. I figured this woman, Margaret, or whatever her name is, has some deep resentment against older men. And are you buying this?
I can't believe you really went for it.
God damn it.
Don't you know? No one knows why anyone does anything.
So normally we go to our guest first, but just this once I have to go to Sarah because you say that all the time when you're talking about true crime. So Furious did not take that tack of nobody knows why anyone does anything. We find out quite a lot about why everyone does absolutely everything. But did that bother you for this reason in terms of how you approach true crime, which this is not?
Not especially. First of all, sidebar, you must remember this season on erotic 80s, I think, includes a meditation on Black Widow and the Teresa Russell oeuvre and is possibly more worthwhile than the movie. I don't know if you would feel the same. I know you listened to that. I think when it comes to men who are serial killers, it is like, basically my thing is like, it's pointless to speculate about why serial killers do what they do because they enjoy torturing and killing people. Like we civilians can't access that style of motivation. Mm-hmm. Female serial killers have a different axis along which they operate and they are fairly rare. I think they did a good job in this case. First of all, there is a line of dialogue or an exchange where they talk about exactly that and the difference between gendered serial killing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it didn't especially bother me because this is part of the bringing order out of chaos of serial killer stories or scripted material is that basically nobody knows anything, Goldman style, and this is just an attempt to sort of try to impose some order on a chaotic evil. But at the same time, I think this chaotic evil in Furious was extremely well cast. Lola Pettigrew can get a lot done with just a like cheek twitch, and that worked for them in Say Nothing, and it worked for them here, I thought.
Mm-hmm. Tim, you are the expert. Was this a story that should have stayed movie-sized, or were you entertained, drawn in by, it sounds like you were on the fence about the adaptation, but would it have been better if it were a sub-2-hour movie versus this 8-hour TV show?
So I hadn't seen the movie. I watched it also this weekend, and I watched the whole 8 episodes of Furious just because I wanted to see how it was going to end.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a big believer in the take a movie that has an interesting premise, but maybe not the best execution, and remake that people will not be clamoring saying, how dare anybody make a remake of Black Widow?
Right.
Black Widow has its fans, but I don't think it's super well remembered. It came out in 87.
Mm-hmm.
It was a decent box office hit. And to the point that you made, Tara, it's the kind of like mid-budget thriller, you know, erotic thriller that they just don't make as movies anymore. Mm-hmm. They make them as Hulu limited series. I mean,
right.
That's where they live now. That's where they reside. While watching Furious, my trajectory with the show was first 2 episodes, interested, curious, feels both kind of trashy and smart at the same time. And then as the show goes along, I think it gets smarter and smarter and more interesting. And I won't say a thing, but I will say I think the last 2 episodes really, really kind of sink the show in a lot of ways and really hurt my overall impression. I like a lot of the performances. I think it's incredibly well cast, kind of from top to bottom.
Mm-hmm.
Even like the smaller roles, I think, are really well cast. I really liked Emmy Rossum a ton in it. Of the 2 leads, you know, it's funny, like if you've seen Black Widow, you haven't really seen Furious. There's not a lot in common other than there's one woman killing people. There's another woman trying to track down that person. That is essentially the only kind of crossover in terms of the movie and the show. But what I think is interesting is I think that on the show, I think Emmy Rossum's character is better developed, better defined. I'm not the biggest SVU fan, but I like how they develop that character and sort of explain the motivations of that character in a way that feel very plausible. With the Catherine character, whatever her real name is, I like that actress a lot. I liked them in a movie called Thursday.
Tuesday.
That they were in. Sorry, it was Tuesday.
It was one of those days.
Yeah, it was Tuesday, and it was with Julia Louis-Dreyfus. They played Julia Louis-Dreyfus's daughter who is dying in that movie, and was really quite good in that. And I like them a lot in Furious. My issue is that the character is kind of like the Joker in The Dark Knight, where they're just good at everything. Like, they're super awesome at doing awesome kidnappings, and because it's slickly made enough, that didn't bother me, but it is one of those things where it's like, boy, this person is really good at all of the crime stuff.
Yeah.
But there are other things that the character is not good at, and it didn't exactly square with the character that we've been introduced to. So that was sort of a bigger issue. I've always liked Scoot McNairy, and I've always kind of wanted him to have a bigger career, and I really like him in this, and that character's relationship with the Alice character. I just think the show gets less smart, which is another way of saying I think there are dumb things that happen as the show goes along. I won't say the specific character because I want to be very careful of spoilers, but I think one character is introduced as being very smart and then does dumb things because the show needs that character to do dumb things.
Mm-hmm.
And to throw, the question in the beginning was, should this be a movie? I didn't mind it being longer. What I have an issue with limited series like this is that there is a constant inherent challenge of we got to have stuff happening. We got to keep throwing obstacles at the characters. And in the second half of this of the limited series, I think those obstacles become much more and then this happens. I don't think the movie is great, but I think the one thing that if this had been a movie, it would have helped. There have been fewer things, fewer obstacles that the characters would have had to deal with because it would have had less runtime. I mean, this is essentially 8-ish hours, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
The original movie is about 1 hour and 45 minutes. Some of the development of the characters is interesting. One of the problems with the movie Black Widow is because it's pre-internet era, Teresa Russell gets to kill people and disappear really, really easily.
A better time. Mm.
Yeah.
It was a more innocent time, Tara. We all were able to kill people and change her. And if mm-hmm. you just looked away from the camera when people took pictures, they could never spot you. That's the way it was in the 80s.
That's right.
That's why we all killed so many people back then.
Killing people and choosing Pepsi. That's what we were doing in the 80s.
I know. Everybody was talking about Alex P. Keaton all the time. It was awesome.
Yeah.
And I think that the show runs out of gas in its second half in terms of plot stuff. And then my final thing, I won't reveal anything about this. I simply don't buy the ending.
Yep.
I simply just do not buy it. I don't think it's provocative, interesting. In some ways, I actually prefer the ending to the original movie. Mm.
Yeah. I feel like another rule of thumb in our whatever matrix, I don't know how we incorporate this, but it's like any series, including true crime docuseries, generally, that it's like it's four parts at 47 minutes each. Like there's that rule of decluttering that's like you have 20% too much of whatever item or group you're like confronting during your spring cleaning. Mm-hmm. You have 20% too much of it. And I think that's true of series run times in the limited series era. Like just cut two off. But that's mm-hmm. not how they do it.
I think Tim's right down the problem with a lot of these sort of crime shows, including Nordic noir shows, which is they just sort of get into like this loop of what's the next obstacle for the cops, and it has to be a little crazier than the last one. Mm-hmm. And if you do too many of those, you start seeing the matrix, just even in the front half of this show, you can kind of see that coming. So again, for me, why I brought up the question of movie or TV right away is because I can sort of start to see those shapes from the first go. Mm-hmm.
Was anyone else put in mind of Killing Eve and how mm-hmm. like a good concept that read as very smart and mm-hmm. something that was, if not completely fresh, then at least was innovating on something that we had seen before with known quantity actors that we had seen before and were enjoying? But then it lost tone mm-hmm. to the, I mean, that was like a longer, that had seasons and whatnot, but sort of halfway through, I was like, diminishing returns. Mm-hmm. Was anyone else put in mind of that show or just me?
I hadn't thought of that, but now that you said it, you're right.
Yeah.
I think.
I could see it.
And I can see them trying to extend this show to past the mm-hmm. finale now that I've seen it. That, yeah. You know.
What is season two called? Enraged.
Furiouser.
Still furious after all these years.
And then the
prequel
is like annoyed? I don't know. Angry, but still in control.
Yes.
Pre-furious. Mm. One of the things I wanted to ask the three of you, I was curious when I watched it, I hadn't thought about the Killing Eve connection, but when I've been reading the reviews so far for Furious, I had noticed that a lot of them say this is a maybe smarter or more nuanced or more sensitive look at this type of material than you get on, say, SVU and those types of shows. Mm-hmm. I don't watch them nearly as much as more of a novice. To me, as somebody who loves the flagship Law and Order show, mm-hmm. but was less, kind of loved SVU a lot less, it feels like sort of a glorified SVU episode where they get to swear and the sexual content is maybe a little more intense and a little more provocative than maybe you could do on SVU. Mm-hmm. But I found myself reading the reviews and saying, I didn't feel like this necessarily is a corrective to any of those types of things or does anything in a more interesting way. But again, that's a novice speaking. I was really curious how you felt about that aspect of the show.
Well, obviously, Sarah is our Law and Order expert here. So, I would just add on to that. Has Law and Order done, I'm sure they have, their Epstein file adjacent storylines and do those compare here? Question.
Like multiple. Yeah. And Weinstein. Yeah. That's a procedural. So, it just depends on whether you think Furious is a procedural or whether it's a like noirish. I mean, I got like Prime Suspect vibes a little bit, just in terms of like everyone here is compromised and this is a good investigator, but she brings her own neuroses and trauma to this. But when it comes to true crime and like unscripted crime stories, you have sort of two versions and they're not trying to do the same thing. The first version is a whodunit, and then the second version is a why society is like this it, mm-hmm. or like how we got here it. Uh-huh. So they're not trying to do the same thing, but it's helpful sometimes to look at procedurals or, like, you know, dead girl dramas, or however you want to deem them, like Mayor of Easttown, Task, prestige murder shows like this. And it's like, all right, is this about the mystery or is it about the solvers?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So from a procedural standpoint, I wouldn't say this is especially remarkable. I thought it was processy enough or, like, believable, I guess. Maybe more Blue Gels than in real life, but it just depends on what you need the show to do and then what it's trying to do. And if those things don't line up in terms of who done it versus why done it, then there will be a satisfaction gap, I would say.
I mean, I don't still watch SVU or Law & Order, but I've watched them a lot. And what struck me is what was different here is that the corruption of police departments is, like, baked in versus either of those shows where, like, maybe once a season you'll get an episode where they're like, and this cop was bad and then we caught him and now everyone else is great.
Right. Yeah. Which they just did on SVU mm-hmm. last year. And it was like, oh, so I see what you're trying to do. And
right.
And then it's like, well, now that we all know, but Benson, she is a captain. She's been a captain for, like, 3 years now. And then mm-hmm. she's just, like, all, like, tearing up and shocked. And it's like, really? You've been NYPD half your life.
Right. But that's the point. Like, they're still doing copaganda. And when they do a story mm-hmm. about one bad apple, that's still copaganda because the implication
is exactly.
This is an outlier versus all our great cops that you watch every week and love. And this mm-hmm. was very different because, especially with the Alice storyline, the reason that she went to the FBI, and this was in the first three episodes, so it's not a spoiler anymore, but she had been dating a fellow detective. He was physically abusive. She just told another friend of hers and didn't even formally report it. And this fellow cop, who's played by Jake Lacy, I thought quite well, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. is still pressuring her to, like, you know, recant even the unofficial story because it's hurting his career and blah, blah, blah. And there's a moment where you think the show is going to be like, oh, he did change. And then he didn't change. And he's still one of the shitbag Jake Lacy characters, not one of the nice, good guy Jake Lacy characters, because there's no in between.
Yeah, I did appreciate that right up top. It's like her aspirational section is the SVU of the FBI.
Right.
And then her putative section chief is like, we work in the basement. Mm-hmm. This lady was talking about how I'm reviewing CSAM, and then she offered you a cheese ball. And then the SFX on that crunch was really sick and perfect. Mm-hmm. And this woman is, like, drunk at work in a victim's hospital room, and that's when this character says, like, you'll never catch anyone who matters. So the fact that they run that up the flagpole in episode one, I think, is of note.
Yeah, Nora is a great character for a while.
You know, Sarah had mentioned Killing Eve earlier. One of the things that I thought about a lot while watching the show was, as you silence the lambs,
mm-hmm.
the idea, and it's not so much the Jodie Foster versus Anthony Hopkins element, but more of the Jodie Foster almost at war at the FBI. Mm-hmm. Like, Jonathan Demme did such a great job of always making her, all the other actors, taller than her. So she was not the only just the only woman, but she was shorter than everybody else around her. And you sense that, the feeling of discomfort everywhere she was. And I think that's actually nicely done throughout the show in terms of your points about police corruption being baked in, that there's really a sense that she's far from perfect, but you definitely get the sense that she's almost on her own in terms of the way people treat her.
Yeah.
Because what Tara alluded to about her backstory and her ex-boyfriend and how people around the New York Police Department feel about her now, that's really well done. And Jake Lacy, I think, is really... This is not obvious child Jake Lacy. This is Jake Lacy. Mm-hmm. But the thing I love is that even within the fact that his character is a jerk, there's just a sliver in there where you keep thinking, oh, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Jake Lacy does such a great job, because I think one of the things you have to be careful on a show like this is not making the people in the audience think, gee, you know, Alice is really stupid for even being around this guy.
Yes.
Afterwards.
Yeah.
You don't want the audience to say, she's dumb or she's weak or anything like that. It has to be much more complicated than that. And Rossum makes that work, but Jake Lacy also makes that work because there's mm-hmm. just enough there where you think, I can see why she stayed with someone since like high school, even though he became an alcoholic and a jerk and abusive. You can see the slivers enough. And I think that's one of the strongest things in the show when they talk about abusive relationships and, you know, and sexual assault and like that, how it is hard sometimes for people to extricate themselves from those relationships.
Yeah.
And that pairing and those performances sell that in a way that the show absolutely needs for it to work.
Yeah, mm. I agree.
All right, before we go, I know this has been a highbrow conversation, but I need to know, Tara, because I forgot to ask you. You were watching Black Widow 1987. I was like, the only thing I remember from Black Widow is there's a lady in the pool. I don't know if it's Deborah Winger.
It's Teresa Russell.
But 15-year-old me self can only remember giant, giant nipples. Was I correct?
You definitely see her nipples. She's in a pool. Uh-huh. They are above the waterline. Yeah. I would not say they're giant. I would say they are cold.
All right. Well, I was much smaller back then, so that makes sense.
Got a lot of shows. It's a great time for shows.
It's time to go around the dial. First off, Tara, what do you got?
From the aspiring sublime to the completely ridiculous, Married at First Sight season 20. It's back on Peacock because the new platform's slightly tweaked format gets everyone through the matchmaking and marriage process much faster than when it was on Lifetime. All the couples were married by the end of the third episode. And when I say all, I mean 7 couples, 14 names I am expected to remember. Like, I don't have my own life to lead.
Do you think they should rename the people so that each couple has an alliterative pairing? So it's easier to track?
Yes.
Okay, great.
They should.
Now, make a note.
After the first 6 episodes of the season, here are my early impressions of each of the couples. So this got them through the weddings, honeymoons, and then moving back to Seattle, which is where the season takes place, and moving into their like furnished apartments that they're in for the length of the experiment. Okay. Adam and Marissa, he is a workout freak. He wants to retire at 40, which means he's also cheap. His gift to Marissa before the wedding is a bunch of pickleball equipment she has no interest in. When people talk at the wedding about how much she loves drinking and taking naps, he seems turned off. She then seems turned off by him holding the whole wedding reception hostage while he plays like 6th grade recital pieces on the piano. Pieces, plural. When they go on their honeymoon, he wears socks in the pool on multiple occasions because he's scared of slipping on the bottom of the pool or pool deck. Despite their many differences.
Wait, scared of slipping on the bottom of the pool?
Yes,
while
Dave,
in the water?
Yes.
How's that even possible?
I don't know, but
he
apparently
found a way.
He's like, you know, what if we're like playing, tossing the football? I don't want to slip. Like, so something happened where you slipped while playing football in the pool and ate shit. Got it.
I mean, I don't want to derail you right away, but maybe somebody could just tell this guy about aqua shoes. At least like you're not jumping in with socks.
No one wears those in pools either. He's a freak.
Okay, but
he wears them when he's going down a water slide. He is a very weird man. Anyway, despite their many differences, they seem to like each other, or they just both really want to be buried. Who knows? Mecca and Belle Jolie. She spells her name with an acute accent over the second E in Belle, but does not pronounce it. I blame that on her mother, who changed her name to Violent Force. That is according to past and future guest Stephanie Green, who found that on Reddit. So, you know, Belle Jolie's name's not her fault. What is Mecca's fault is he had tooth gems. They don't have any early issues other than I think they're both on the show to promote themselves because she's a singer-songwriter and he's a part-time model. Part-time porta-potty cleaner. Not joking. Moving on.
Wait, Philippe. Hang on. Before we move on,
yeah.
I just want everybody to think about what their equivalent of Violent Force would be if they had to choose a name like that. Mine's Big Explosion. Think about it, Sarah. Think about it, Tim.
Okay. Felipe and Tori, he gave himself a glow up a few years ago, now seems to think he is super hot, which is not my experience of looking at him. However, he has a lot of confidence, such that as the Brazilian-American owner of an Italian restaurant, he is constantly picking up women at work. This is probably going to be a problem, even though he did tell Tori on their honeymoon that he cheated once. It is almost certainly more than once. At the end of the 6th episode, they have sex for the first time. Then we see her leave the bedroom alone and sleep on the couch. So seems like she instantly has regrets about that, and I don't blame her. Nick and Courtney. This is the 5th or 6th reality show that Nick has been on. He was previously a contestant on The Circle, which he parlayed into a stint on Perfect Match. He was also a pit crew guy on Drag Race. which when one of his friends tells Courtney at the wedding, she's like, oh, cool, my family's really into cars, and then has to find out for the first time what RuPaul Drag Race is in 2026. Courtney is a competitive bodybuilder from a family full of them. She also describes herself as conservative, but in the matchmaking process, when one of the new experts, the man, I don't remember his name, I will not look it up, asks what she thinks about what happened on January 6th, and she's like, remind me what that one was, and he's like, got it. Courtney thinks Nick is boring. Unfortunately, she is right. That is tough to overcome. Guys, we're almost done. We're over the hump, actually. Cameron and Michelle. He is a crazily tall former pro basketball player in Europe. He has never been in a long-term relationship before. He's in his late 30s or possibly 40s, so not great.
Does he have a cat named Ferguson?
He does not. Yeah. Michelle talks like this. Let's hear the clip.
Well, I'm sad to leave this room.
I know.
It's just wild to think that we only met a few days ago, and it feels like we're a team in so many ways. And I feel really comfortable with you. Like, it's easy to be vulnerable.
So another Liz from Kroll Show, like all the boobs on Million Dollar Nannies. There was another clip where she was, you could hear her vocal fry more, but it's when she was talking about having had fibroids and how that impacted her fertility. So it felt like it was in poor taste to clip it. But, you know, other than him towering over her in a way that is uncomfortable to see on screen, they might both be boring enough to work out. Sean and Nikki, at 48 and 46, they are this season's senior citizen couple. At the wedding, she comes to the altar and sees him and is like, do I wait here for my husband? So that's awkward. She does not get more attracted to him from there. They are doomed. He also doomed his career as a would-be college president if anyone in a position to hire him finds out this show exists.
Would-be college president.
He's a VP of admissions now. They did not say
T-shirt.
Where. Oh, my God. And he makes so many jokes. Makes a 69 joke the day of the wedding. Like, guy. Anyway, Devin and Caitlin. Nice. He is a professional rugby player, which I guess can be a full-time job in Seattle. News to me. He looks like if Tim Key was in a sketch about an extreme athlete. He has bleached hair and a shaved-sized mullet. And he kept his sunglasses on the top of his head throughout the wedding ceremony.
Cool. That guy probably make a really good ski instructor back in 1986.
Aha. Uh-huh. They were not Oakleys, but they were Oakley adjacent. Despite all that, he seems like a dumb sweetie. And his biggest problem is he's super clingy and Caitlin is turned off by it. On the honeymoon, there's one morning where she sets an alarm, gets up at 8:30, sees him like open his eyes, look at her, and put his head back down and go back to sleep. So she leaves for the gym without him, and he is upset about it for days. He's like, I thought we made plans to go to the gym. He tells all the other newlyweds about what he terms the gym incident. So unless he is able to back off and let her miss him a little, they are also doomed. But let's be real, they're probably all doomed, like every single one of the couples from season 19. None of them worked out, and probably none of these will either. And that is your Married at First Sight season 20 update.
Thank you, Tara.
For my plug.
Wait, again, hang on.
Yes?
We have to find out our violent names.
Oh, yes, your violent force.
Yeah. Violent force, Sarah. Mm-hmm.
White collar crime.
Okay, Tim.
Slippery pool feet.
Thank you. Excellent. For my plug, again with this club, we are about to talk about the July episodes of 90210 OMG, Jenny and not Tori's podcast.
Because
she quit. She got out while the getting was not good. It's season 8. It's the getting is bad, but whatever. We're going to be talking about that.
Not what
soon.
I thought was going to happen.
Plot no.
Twist,
of the
baby.
Two to quit, did not think it would be her. So anyway, we'll have plenty to say about that. Again, with this podcast.com/club, just $5 to join or $4 if you make an annual.
All right. Slippery pool feet. What do you got for us?
It's like the middle of a baseball season, which is my happy time of year because I love baseball so much. But this is usually the time of the season where, because the weather is getting warmer and warmer, a lot of teams are starting to fade and sort of proving that they're not going to make it to the playoffs because they're just not good enough. My Cardinals look like they may be one of those teams, unfortunately. And so I've been trying to find baseball-related things to make me feel better and to forget about my Cardinals. I'm also a big fan of the Lonely Island and Seth Meyers podcast, Woo-hoo! Which is funny because I am not necessarily somebody who loves, hey, let's listen to famous people talk about their stuff. But I really, kind of from the beginning, have loved this podcast. And one of the reasons why I love it so much, for people who don't know, essentially that this has evolved over time, essentially each episode is devoted to them going through one of the digital shorts they did as the Lonely Island on Saturday Night Live. And the thing I've come to really love about the show, beyond just their rapport, is actually hearing them kind of get into the weeds in terms of why certain shorts worked, especially why certain shorts didn't work. It's really kind of a fascinating thing from like a filmmaking standpoint, as they kind of go into these very like kind of small comedic things and like what they would do differently. And weirdly enough, a lot of those shorts hold up. They have not gone yet to talking about something that they did kind of on a lark in 2019, which was called the Unauthorized Bashed Brothers Experience. It was, and I'd forgotten this until I did the research for us to talk about it today, it was a surprise release. It was just dropped on Netflix one day in May of 2019. For people who don't remember the Unauthorized Bashed Brothers Experience, it is a visual poem. It's about a half an hour long that essentially dramatizes the era in the late 1980s when the Oakland A's were the biggest baseball team in Major League Baseball. They were led by two home run hitting machines named Jose Canseco and Mark McGwire, who were played by Andy Samberg and Akiva Schaffer from the Lonely Island. Those two guys who hit so many home runs, later were found out that they took a bunch of steroids, which is why they did so well. The Unauthorized Bash Brothers Experience is about them at the height of their celebrity and also their downfall when people find out that they started using steroids. People don't remember visual albums anymore, but they were a huge thing in the late 2010s where artists wouldn't just release albums. They would release like a album-length video, like a mini movie. There were always these like glossy, high production value, totally pretentious things that were like a visual accompaniment to their album. The people most remember is Beyoncé's Lemonade that was dropped the same time that the album came out. And people like studied the album for all of these, or rather the visual album, for all these clues into the record and what Beyoncé was trying to say. That thing is very much a thing of the past. And so if people go back and watch the Unauthorized Bash Brothers Experience, they may not remember what they're actually making fun of, but that actually is what mm-hmm. they're doing. And you can tell because there are so many Terrence Malick ripoff shots in the Unauthorized Bash Brothers Experience, because mm-hmm. anybody who made a visual album back then basically told their director, I want lots of shots of nature, especially if the camera is low and you're tracking across the wilderness, because I want a lot of trees, because that's what makes something really kind of artsy and cool. There's a ton of those shots in the Unauthorized Bash Brothers Experience. But what's also very fun is that this was a couple of years after Popstar, like 3 years after Popstar. And this is like the second time that The Lonely Island did something that was not just musical, but also had a narrative as a part of the music. You can see similarities between the two projects. But a lot of these songs are like 2 minute long things. Some of it references stuff from the 1980s. There's like callbacks to Janet Jackson. There is a keyboard riff that is exactly like the outro to George Michael's Father Figure, which I absolutely adore. It is so nicely done. But there's also a lot of, because they're from the Bay Area, they do a lot of like Bay Area rap and hyphy and stuff like that. So like they know that world. And so if you know baseball, it's really funny. If you know the 80s music scene, but also the hip hop scene of the East Bay, you will also really enjoy it. It's also like a kind of a weird thing because they basically made it for no money. They kind of did it on their own and Netflix was like, yeah, sure, we'll put that out. That sounds fun. And it feels like this weird, like, what the hell thing that they did that's not talked about as much as their movies and their digital shorts. And because I don't want to watch actual baseball right now because it just causes me pain, I enjoy laughing for a half an hour at these guys. And oh, by the way, in one of the songs, Sia does a guest, like does the chorus, but they didn't have Sia in the film. So they had their buddy Sterling K. Brown do the Sia part. And it's really, really fun.
I forgot about that. Yeah. I think I watched that on your couch.
Yes, I believe I made you watch it the last time you yes. were in Austin. So, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know anything about old school hip hop or baseball, and I still loved it.
Yep. Good pick.
Anything to plug, Tim?
So, speaking of television, I rewatched Wonder Man recently and really, really enjoyed the show. And one of the reasons I like the show so much is how much I like Yahya Abdul-Mateen II. Coming out pretty soon, like early August, I have an interview with him for the Los Angeles Times where I talk a little bit about kind of his career trajectory, why this show is kind of him going back to the beginning of his acting career. I mean, it's remarkable to think he's really only been professionally acting for about 10 years. He graduated from Yale Drama when he was 29. He turned 40 in mid-July. And all the work that he's done, whether it's Top Dog, Underdog, or Watchmen, or Aquaman, or Wonder Man, it's like all within like the last 9-10 years. And so I really enjoyed talking to him. My piece will be up over at the LA Times, I would say sometime first week of August.
Great.
Sarah D. Bunting.
That's WCC to you.
Sorry.
Yeah, Wonder Man is really kind of an underrated show that I feel like in the last few months, people have been going back and finishing it and being like, oh yeah, that ruled.
Yeah.
I agree. I'm not here to talk about that, though. I'm here to talk about The Westies. That is the new gangster crime drama on MGM Plus, a real streamer that exists. It was created by Michael Panis and Chris Brancato, vets of Godfather of Harlem, Narcos, and Hannibal, variously. And it stars J.K. Simmons as Eamon Sweeney, an Irish gangster trying to get a piece of Javits Center grift and graft in early 80s New York City. Titus Schwellever as a cop on the take who is reluctantly drafted as a double agent on the FBI's Gambino task force thanks to his shitty kid. I'm somewhat paraphrasing. Grant Chester's Tom Brittany as Westie Lieutenant Jimmy Rourke and various other BritBox and or Sopranos grads, including Michael Rispoli as a Gambino underboss. Most of the reviews up to this point have called the show familiar and predictable, which it kind of is, but impressively acted, which I guess it also is. The world-building beats of the premiere were sufficiently routine that I wouldn't say either Simmons or Welliver was pushed out of his comfort zone particularly. Certainly the performances are, so far, not quite riveting enough to distract from the obvious Torontoniness of the location shots, and certain aspects of the production design are inattentive to the differences between 1978 and 1981 in costume and cars, and Tom Brittany's wig is both bad and unnecessary, as are various dialogue winks to the audience so that we know the show knows what happens to Paul Castellano in the end and at whose hand. Like, yes, we get it. But at the same time, it's very watchable in this B-movie way that MGM Plus content tends to have. That's how Richard Roper put it in his review for RogerEbert.com. We'll link that in the show notes. And I think that's exactly right, and that there is plenty of room for that kind of show. It's not high art, but it's not trying to be that. It's not as sharply observed as it could be, but it's treading different enough ground in a very familiar, popular genre. And it's using enough compelling character briefs to do it. For instance, there's a character named Mickey Flanagan, Vietnam vet struggling with mental illness, who reads as both Ziggy from season 2 of The Wire and also the character's path to that way of being in the world is completely different from Ziggy. Stanley Morgan's performance of Mickey is dimensioned when it actually doesn't have to be, and it's watchable. I think I'm going to keep on with it, at least for a few episodes. I believe as of our recording this, 4 out of 8 episodes have dropped. Sometimes it's like good enough, like it's a gangster procedural. Why not? For my plug, us, why not? Actually, I mean the Extra Hot Great Club membership. You guys keep the lights on around here. We are very grateful for you. And if you would like to pay it forward for a fellow listener, we have a mutual aid vault for club memberships. The donation process is quite straightforward, but you can email me directly for more information, bunting@tomatonation.com, or you can DM me on our Discord. If you would like to withdraw from the vault, same contact info. It's anonymous on all sides except for me, and co-host listener privilege will pertain.
Thank you for considering it and for being here. We appreciate you.
All right, coming up Friday on the club episode Extra Extra Hot Great, 422 is one of my favorite formats to see. Let's watch a bunch of old commercials and talk about them. This batch, found by Tara, comes from 40 years ago.
Yeah, 40 years ago this week.
Not possible. Mm-hmm. That and much more on that episode, go to extrahotgreat.com/club to join today and then come back here next week, EHG Prime. We're welcoming back Carrie Race and we're going to be talking about Sterling Point.
I get it.
Yeah, callback.
Nice.
All right.
If the world were like a Sleep Number mattress, everything would adapt for your comfort. Your coffee would never get cold. Your flight would always be on time. And your mattress would always respond to you and your unique sleep needs. Sleep Number mattresses are designed to respond to your body and shift with your changing life, helping you fall asleep faster and stay asleep longer. To experience a whole new world of comfort, visit a Sleep Number store or go to sleepnumber.com. Sleep Number, to a good life's sleep.
It is time for the Extra Hot Great Canon presenting this week. It's Tara.
Hello. As an anthology series, Documentary Now varies widely from episode to episode, depending on the material it is iterating on. But there are a few attributes that all the great episodes have in common. Here's what I would say those are and how they are evident in Season 4, Episodes 1 and 2, Soldier of Illusion, Parts 1 and 2. Number one, it is inspired by iconic material or personalities. And I know the word iconic is overused, but in this case, it actually applies. One of the gags of Documentary Now is that for most of our lives, the titular genre has been undersung and kind of geeky. Before streaming, if you were interested in watching a documentary feature, you probably had to put in a little effort to find it, unless it came from a name brand filmmaker. Since Werner Herzog is about as famous as a documentary filmmaker can be, the fact that Documentary Now took 3 full seasons before even approaching his oeuvre shows admirable restraint from the creative team. Having made the choice to take on Herzog, not only a prolific director, but one who often appears on camera in his films, Documentary Now's viewers would have very high expectations. As far as this viewer is concerned, it meets them immediately. Clip one.
The last time I stood on these ignorant stones, I was a younger man, filled with Bavarian pride. I had taken 2 jobs at once, and with the vinegar of the pumpers declared I could shoot both projects at the same time, on the same location. Here. One was a film chronicling the life of the Dushkir people during their Tushin sheep breeding season. The other was a CBS sitcom called Bachelor Nanny, the story of a single guy who, after agreeing to take in his sister's twin newborns, has to juggle babies and babes.
That's Alexander Skarsgård as Reiner Volt, the stand-in for Werner Herzog here. Number two, it puts a twist on the material that would be impossible to predict. I love Documentary Now, but this element is not always present. Redoing the September issue about the production of a small town beauty salon's lookbook, as in 2 hairdressers in Bagleyport, isn't such a departure. Any Given Sunday Afternoon about a bowling league is just based on a documentary about a bowling league. But when you start with the filmography of Werner Herzog, recurring themes of nonconformity and conflicts of man versus nature offer many potential angles for parody. Starting with an immersive, experiential film and adding the shoot of a crass, disposable 80s sitcom pilot to that is, I feel, a choice that only the minds behind Documentary Now could even think to make. Number three, it gives you just enough of what you want. Early on, you can tell Soldier of Illusion is in part a gloss on Burden of Dreams, Les Blank's documentary about the making of Herzog's scripted film, Fitzcarraldo. And if you did not see where it was going, seeing all the Bachelor Nanny set furniture being carried by hand over Forbidding Mountains probably tipped you off. And once you know that, you might try to figure out which of the stars of Bachelor Nanny is going to disrupt the production and clash with Reiner. In other words, who's going to be Reiner's Klaus Kinski? Turns out it won't be Gary Jacks or Kevin Butterman or any of the 4 non-baby twins cast to play the show's baby twins. Where it goes starts with Gary being asked to participate in a Dushkir ceremony called the Wolf Game, clip 2.
This is so weird. Okay, what do I do?
A wolf. You must kill him.
He's a wolf, and I just kill him with this plant thing, right?
Kill him.
Okay, you are a wolf, and you must
The wolf was your brother. You killed your brother.
You told me to kill him.
He's been Ivan. You must beg the wolf for forgiveness. Now, now.
I'm so sorry. Please forgive me. I didn't even know I had a brother.
The wolf spirit accepted Gary's apology. To celebrate, we shared a meal of Ufa, and Gary Jax signed a few headshots. He was now a part of the tribe.
Put a pin in that, because not long after the production's doing a hair and makeup test when the Dushkir village is invaded by starving bears, Reiner's mysterious AD, Halftone, fights back against the bear and saves what crew members he can. But yes, we do have to take a detour to Grizzly Man, clip 3.
After the violence that Halftone committed that day, I would only ever show this footage to CBS head of comedy, Alani Hafa.
That shirt is good, right? Mm-hmm. You like the shirt?
The makeup test would prove successful.
Is that a bear?
Yeah.
However, the orgy of violence that followed it would be another story.
Jesus Christ.
Halfto's attack was so swift and brutal that the Kamchatka bear and his girlfriend survived 68 stab wounds before escaping to the safety of death.
Ah!
No one can see this.
I agree. I will destroy the footage, or it will continue to haunt us forever.
Are they going to try something different with Gary Jack's hair?
Yes, of course.
Speaking of Gary, clip 4.
Under Andropov, the Soviet Union had outlawed indigenous activities and games. Footage of Gary Jax playing the wolf game had fallen into the hands of the KGB.
They're saying they will shut down filming and expel all of us. Or they can take Gary Jax. If we promise not to make an international incident out of it, they will let us continue.
That's a wrap on Gary. We never find out what happens to him either, by the way. Enter Dieter Daimler, Reiner's frequent star and tormentor, clip 5.
Hey! Reiner! Du Fotze! Ich bin Helios!
That's I Am the Sun in German. Gary had just hoped for a long-running job that would keep him paid for decades. Dieter has a habit on every shoot of nearly killing people, so it's a different energy. Number 4, it gives you lots of what you didn't know you needed. It's not possible for me to highlight all of the Bachelor Nanny-related gags. It's clear that the episode's credited writer John Mulaney has a deep knowledge of 80s sitcom production and probably had 50 more jokes he had to cut, but here are a few of the ones that make it in. CBS's head of comedy, Alan Yaffa, bringing his various showbiz awards to his yurt. The Bachelor Nanny set furnishings include a couch shaped like a pair of lips and a neon Budweiser sign in the shape of a guitar. The casting of the girl in a sitcom like this is such an afterthought that Brian the Bachelor Nanny's wisecracking landlady can be played by Masho, the Dushkir chieftain's daughter who speaks no English. The plan to approximate studio conditions in an abandoned boron mine is abandoned itself when a local geologist explains that speaking above a child's whisper will cause the mine to collapse, at which Reiner tiptoes out, leaving the geologist on his own. Reiner closing his taping intro by reading a list of crew members who died from exposure during pre-production, and this, clip 6.
In order to get the best crowd reactions, the network has insisted on not using a local audience. Instead, they want to fly people from Woodland Hills, California, the suburb where major films are focus grouped. While they are fat, corpulent ignorance does enrage me. I have to agree. They do make the best test audiences.
Tape night is interrupted when tribesmen from a neighboring village raid the set. Hilariously, the footage of villagers fighting on the set while cameras are still rolling is so garishly lit that even the violence reads like any other sitcom of the era. But if you think Reiner would abandon this project midway through just because of dozens of casualties, you don't know Reiner. Clip 7.
Filming was paused for the day. The audience was given a small per diem and pizza to stay the night, while art department mopped up the carnage and redressed the set. At dawn the next day, we filmed the final scene. The events and hardships of the journey were evident in the breathtaking performances.
Oh, April. You really mean it? I mean, you won't evict me for having two baby twins?
Sure, they can stay. You whine more than them anyway.
Man, that's great. She seems cool for someone you called Attila the Bay.
April, don't listen to him.
Did you mean that?
But of course not. I was joking.
What about the babe part?
You could quote me on that.
That the show makes it to air with Dieter playing the role in presumably 22 episodes and gets him nominated for an Emmy is the best gag of all. Number 5, it's anchored by an incredible performance you would never see if this show did not exist. I know that Werner Herzog's trademark world-weary narration makes him a frequent subject for impressionists. At this point, I have loved Paul F. Tompkins' take for over a decade, but embodying Reiner at two very different moments in his long life, Alexander Skarsgård is on another level. For example, clip 8.
Well, when a camera is brought into nature, like the tool given to the jester monkey, the very state of nature is changed. A wilderness with a camera in it is no longer a wilderness. It is something else. When you add another camera to that, you are adding a camera to a new thing, which is a wilderness with already a camera in it. Each lens distorts the previous distortion. And what you are left with at the end, it's not a wilderness anymore, but an illusion resembling a wilderness.
Some real Mojo Jojo energy there with that narration.
Yes.
In the camera, the wilderness, and the wilderness is in the camera.
Just a couple of minutes later, we get this, clip 9.
Alan Yaffa at CBS and Sharon Schuster at Lorma, who I love, everyone loves Sharon, they came to me with this piece, Bachelor Nanny, after seeing a 3-hour film of mine, The Trials of Master Freim.
Obviously, the real Werner Herzog must know a lot about how to navigate the entertainment industry to have gotten so many films made, but the idea of someone based on this thoughtful, curious intellectual having opinions about studio executives is so funny to me. Skarsgård seems to take every loony role that is offered to him, and thank God, but this one is the sort of thing that couldn't have happened except in the peak TV era that is now certainly over. We should all be grateful that it lasted long enough for Skarsgård to show up in it, just being the tallest, handsomest, weird little freak working on screen today. I wish I could say this episode is perfect. Alas, a cut to a newspaper report on the announcement of Bachelor Nanny that name drops screenwriting legend Babalu Mandel misspells his surname as Mendel, but other than that, it's pretty unimpeachable. Vote it into the canon or I will turn you in to the KGB.
Thank you, Tara. Boy, I'm looking forward to Tim's take on this, being our film expert. Tim, what do you think about the show and Tara's argument for it?
I mean, Tara makes the argument for it. And I really love, Tara, what you said about the reasons what makes a good episode of Documentary Now. Mm-hmm. To put my cards on the table, I am torn about this episode. I like Documentary Now a lot, but I think that you're absolutely right about what makes an episode of Documentary Now really special. I think for me, what I like most about this episode is all the TV stuff. That, I think, is the stuff that works really, really well. And like you said, the juxtaposition of a Werner Herzog-like figure being forced to work in that world, work on a crappy sitcom. I mean, there's no illusion that Bachelor Nanny is just garbage. And I think that's like one of the best things. Like, one of the things that you said, I completely agree with, is that John Mulaney doesn't just know that world. He really loves junky 80s stuff. Like, he really, really, like, he knows it really well, and he loves it. The only thing I think that you didn't mention that's great about the episode is the logo for Bachelor Nanny on the jackets is perfect. That's exactly right. That's exactly what that crew jacket would look like. Mm-hmm. And so I think I am more... I get more stuck on the actual Herzog stuff. I also love Paul F. Tompkins' impression. And actually, after rewatching this episode, I rewatched Paul F. Tompkins doing his comedy Bang Bang Herzog thing, which I just love so much. When he's talking about doing Good Will Hunting 2, it's just so good. It's just so good. I think for me, and I don't know if this is because I'm a film guy, I have a pretty high bar when it comes to Herzog impressions and just jokes about Herzog. And I think that the episode is the best and the performance is the best when Skarsgård stretches out ooze. And there were several in the clips that you had and made me laugh every... When he talks about that syllable especially, he nails. And it's really, really well done. I found myself thinking, I feel like I've seen this impression before. It's a good impression, but I feel like I've seen the impression before. And I would say that for me, with Documentary Now episodes, I tend to like them better when they're about one film, because I feel like they can drill down in a way. Mm-hmm. Like, I love the Artist is Present, Marina Abramović episode. I love Salesman. I love Co-op. When they're really, like, specifically just being like, this is this movie, and we're going to do our own version of it. And this one, it's a little more diffuse, mm-hmm. and it works a little bit less well for me. As somebody who loves his documentary Into the Abyss, I forgot and loved that the end of the episode actually ends with a extended reference to Into the Abyss. But I also feel like with Documentary Now episodes, I think they work really well when they kind of get in and they get out. And because this episode is a two-parter, mm-hmm. it's longer. It's more ambitious and elaborate. I felt like it was a little more stretched out than the episodes that I really love, which kind of brings to mind the question of, like, am I being too hard in terms of what's canon and what's not? So I went back and looked at the list of other episodes. And to me, there were like at least six or seven that I just think are stronger and better. I think this one is really good, but I felt like the sitcom stuff is really funny. But the Herzogian stuff and the references, like you played the clip of the film that he made where he has the little person, I think, in it. That stuff feels a little more familiar. And the surprise, like you talked about when you were laying it out, the surprise of the sitcom and doing that stuff, I think, is the strongest stuff. I would also say that Fred Armisen is sometimes an acquired taste for me.
Sure.
And I don't entirely love him. The joke that you played is my favorite one, the reference to Grizzly Man. He says, you're going to change the hair, right? Oh, yeah. That's really funny. Mm-hmm. I feel like Armisen often thinks his performance is funnier than I think the performance is funny. So it's like if we were talking about recommending it, I like this episode quite a lot, but I found myself holding back on giving it a canon, though I have to say your argument for it was incredibly well put together and made me think, am I being too hard on this? I do think I would probably not go for canon, but it was close for me.
Thank you, Tim. Sarah?
I'd like to focus for a moment. Yeah, I have a Herzog imitation. It is one word. It's the word focus. I am known for it in the Bunting family. Thank you. I will not be taking questions. I thought this was brilliant because it does both things. Like, I don't disagree that Documentary Now can be sharper and feel more necessary when it is taking a single property and drilling down. But I have read Herzog's Conquest of the Useless 3 times. He just has such a way of putting things. And I think that Mulaney has also spent as much time with Herzog's work, with Herzog's phrasings and interviews, with the book Herzog on Herzog, and with his like weird codependent, fraternally abusive relationship with Klaus Kinski. That Kinski impression was like the parts of Kinski that make him interesting and like compelling and ensorcelling, but without being quite as repellent as Kinski can sometimes be. And I think that it's that combination, that sort of like the soft serve swirl of flavors of this looks and feels like what it was like to haul a fucking ship over a literal mountain while they were trying to film Fitzcarraldo. And then at the same time, Herzog is keeping an extremely detailed impressionistic diary on like matchbooks and leaves, and everyone's feet are literally moldering. It was a miserable shoot, and he spoke about it so beautifully and immersively, and you get that sense of that part of it from these episodes. But then it's like, well, but what if the extra, like the extra thing that he's trying to do at the same time, since he already hucked all this equipment out to the middle of nowhere, is a sitcom and all of that stuff, like the lips couch, the old Diet Pepsi can.
Yeah.
This is exactly the script. This is exactly the yellow and blue color combination. This is perfect. His enthusiasm for reading the, like, basically subtitling the lady love interest. Gigantic laugh. I just had many gigantic laughs, but also this is the best of documentary now in that it has this felt experience fondness for all aspects of what it is satirizing. And that's what makes this amazing. Like, and that there are just these little visuals that are like very funny, but also strangely beautiful, like the applause sign that is like lit by fire that he finds in a heap. I was much more impressed with it. I agree, Armisen is like often the rotten banana in the smoothie, I think that he was used to exactly the right effect. This was a delight to revisit, and I would watch it again anytime, but I'm looking forward to hearing Dave's focused comments on Herzog and Perfect Strangers meeting together in a Carvel cup.
Yeah. I enjoyed this quite a bit, and just listening to Tar's argument, if I was coming into this blind, the opening line that has the phrase, ignorant stones. I mean, if you're not sold there, I don't know. I think you're lost. I guess the only thing I really want to shine a light on for this episode is just how well they nailed the production, the look of it, the imitation of the filmic qualities of the time. The one detail that really impressed me is when they showed the title of the documentary, it fades in a period appropriate way. If they just did it, you know, with their computers and left it the way they do now, it would fade from white to gray. But because they're using optical effects and using rubies and all this kind of stuff back in the day, usually it would fade to red before it fades out. And they captured that little moment. So things like that, I thought, really speak to the attention to detail. If you want to reproduce that logo, the fonts you want are Souvenir and Bookman.
Mm-hmm.
Skarsgård's performance here, I really enjoyed. So and I think he is the one known face that I would like to keep if I could recast this. I definitely would have taken Fred Armisen out because he feels like he is an intruder into what they're trying to do with this episode. I feel like he is the face that kind of takes me out of this and reminds me that this is a Hollywood production that they're all making. Like, I don't think Mulaney would be the same problem with him.
Or Bill Hader.
Right.
Who's not in the season at all.
The rest of the cast and this are, they're really great and they all perform their roles well. And I kind of wish we could have had another unfamiliar face at the Fred Armisen character. I think it would have worked a bit better there. But just overall, not the most sort of like ha 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 belly laughs episode of documentary now. For me, that is always going to be Co-op.
Mm-hmm. Which is already in the canon, too.
It's already in the canon.
Yes.
But this one, the care that went into recreating the mood of it and the idea that we're combining this with a CBS comedy is just like a really funny concept. And yeah, it probably would have been better if it was shorter, but I didn't mind it. Let's make this official. Tim Grierson, what say you here? Sounds like you're on the fence leaning no, but let's make it official.
I am on the fence leaning no.
Okay. Sarah D. Bunting.
As I explained to a seismologist, it's a yes for me.
It's a yes for me too. So Documentary Now, Season 4, Episodes 1 and 2, Soldier of Illusion. You are hereby inducted into the Extra Hot Great Canon.
Americans love a winner.
Yup.
And will not tolerate a loser.
Nope.
All right, we're running long, so quickly, please. Winner and loser of the week is coming at you. Sarah, who is this week's winner?
Well, it feels awkward to phrase this as a winner under any circumstances, but especially after our conversation about Copaganda. However, it is On Patrol : Live, which has now gathered the entire Live PD gang back together. Tom Morris Jr. has joined the new show. There's just Abrams, and watching police departments is like a weeble. It won't fall down. We've tried.
When I saw the doc, my brain said Paw Patrol, and I was like, wow, crazy.
Yeah.
Tara, loser.
My loser is Mary Beth Barone, one of the stars of Overcompensating, who said recently on the Talk Easy podcast that she and Benito Skinner, the creator and star of Overcompensating, also her co-host on Barone's podcast Ride, have tried to get out of their contract at Dear Media because the CEO's politics do not align with theirs. So, A, what I'm hearing is someone pays you to make a podcast, brag, sort of. But then, B, I was curious who else has podcasts on this network, and the most famous people are probably Aaron and Sarah Foster of Nobody Wants This Fame. That's where their podcast is. I have not seen them say they were trying to get out of their podcast contract, just saying. But I'm going to link in the show notes to the page of all of the Dear Media shows, because it is really a masterclass in cliches of what people put in, like, the cover art for their podcast. Like, so many cocktails, so many cups of coffee. Like, some of them are even those things are in the name. Very lazy. It's like an other two cutaway joke about the cliches of podcasts. So, you know, that was an education for me.
Speaking about things that are educational for you, do you know what time it is?
It's game time.
Oh, game time.
Game time.
You know, we got a lot of people listening to this podcast. If somebody could tell me what's wrong with my eyes that they've been producing goop for the last 2 months nonstop, I would love to hear it. I'm sure it's something terrible and I'm about to die, but it would be nice to know. All right, this is game time. It is the eighth of the season. The scores are Tara has 4.
Oh.
She wins today. She could clinch it. Sarah's got 2. Value guests have 1. Today, we're playing Name and Name from Me. In honor of last week's guest, Will Leach, and his partner in movie podcast crime, Tim Grierson of Grierson and Leach, I'm going to test your knowledge of Name and Name TV shows. I will give you a version of the TV show titles where you get the other parts of the name. So if it's Name and Name first names, I'm going to give you Name and Name last names. For example, if Tim's podcast was a TV show, I would give you the clue Tim and Will.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Guess it there. You get 3 points. If you get it wrong, we'll move on. I will give you some metadata about the show, year it debuted, the genre, and the network in which it started. Answer there for 2 points. If you still don't get it, you already need to pass. I will give you the first names of the actors in that format. So the people that played those titular roles in the same order, I will give you the actor's first name. 1 point there. Steel meal situation pleased her.
First of all, it sounds like you guess at every level.
Oh, yeah. You betcha.
Steel meal situation. Sarah D. Bunting has 2. I have 6. Tim has Eric's meal, so 1, which rolls over.
Let's throw it to Picky to see our order today.
We will start with Sarah.
All right. Sarah's in the hot seat, and then we're going to go to Tim, then Tara. 27 questions, 1 gross worth equalizer challenge zone in the middle of things. Are we ready to play Name and Name, Sarah?
Yes.
All right. I'm giving you the names of the characters we don't get in the real title. You must give me the real title. Here we go. Giving you all what I hope are softballs. Hork and Cat. Hoke and Cat. Hoke and Cat.
Oh, Ren and Stimpy.
Ren and Stimpy. Yes, that is correct. Stimpson J. Cat is Stimpy's full name.
Nice.
To Tim, you've got Keegan Michael and Jordan.
Key and Peele.
Key and Peele, also good for 3 points. Tara.
Yes.
Truman and Adler.
Will and Grace.
Will and Grace. Everybody's got 3 points. All right. More softballs for you. Sarah. Christine and Mary Beth.
Cagney and Lacey.
Cagney and Lacey is correct for another 3. These are last names for Tim. We've got Squirrel and Moose.
Squirrel and Moose.
Squirrel and Moose. That is the name of the show.
Well, Rocky and Bullwinkle.
Rocky and Bullwinkle is correct. Rocket J. Squirrel, Bullwinkle J. Moose. Tara.
Yep.
DeFazio and Feeny.
Laverne and Shirley.
All right. Everybody has maximum points. Everybody has 6 points. Now, less easy. Here okay. we go. Sarah. Jane and Mora.
Jane and Mora. Rizzoli and Isles?
You are correct, yes.
What, really?
Correct, cool. Yes. All right, Tim. Turner and Whitney. Turner and Whitney.
Turner and Whitney. Yeah. I'm going to need a clue.
All right, this is a 1980 detective comedy on ABC. And to remind you, of course, all the titles in this show are something and something. Correct answer here is worth 2 points. Turner and Whitney, 1980s detective comedy, ABC. Still got one more clue in the wings.
Give me one more clue.
Your actor first names who played these titular characters are Ben and Jeff. Ben and Jeff.
I'm going to phone a friend. Wait, I can't do that. I do not know.
Is one of your friends Jeff Goldblum? Because this is 10 Speed and Brown Shoe.
Okay.
Oh. Yeah.
All right.
Does Sarah have a Jeff Goldblum impression?
No. There is no impression, too.
Tara.
Just the one.
Yes.
Biggs and Flynn. Biggs and Flynn.
Hint.
This is a 2010 sitcom on CBS.
Give me another hint, please.
Your actors are Billy and Melissa.
Billy and Melissa.
Yeah.
I still don't know.
Anybody? Steel Mill? No. That's Mike and Molly.
Oh.
Oh, sure.
Right. Back to Sarah. You've got Milton and Mark. Milton and Mark. This is a toughie.
Starsky and Hutch.
It is a 1983 action crime drama that debuted on ABC.
Jake and the Fat Man.
Okay. Starring Brian and Daniel.
Oh, that's not what I thought.
Brian and Daniel.
Yeah. And if I'm remembering this right, I think it has sort of a conceptual lineage to one of your favorite dumb shows, but I'm not 100% on that.
It's not Simon and Simon, so I don't know.
That's what I thought it was, too.
Any guesses? This is Hardcastle and McCormick.
Oh.
They've involved a car. Uh-huh. A supercar of some sort.
Right. Yeah.
To Tim, you've got Lee and Amanda. Lee and Amanda is your hidden part of the name title. Lee and Amanda.
It's not Cagney and Lacey.
No.
Give me a hint.
This is a 1983 action comedy romance on CBS. Doing a lot of work here.
You said CBS?
Yeah, CBS. Action comedy romance from 83.
Lee and Amanda.
Yeah, those are your character names.
I'll take one more hint.
Okay, your actor's first name, Bruce and Kate. Bruce and Kate. If he doesn't get this right, somebody can steel mail this for a delicious point. Deep in thought.
Simon and Simon.
Simon and Simon is not correct.
I will steel meal this.
Oh, go ahead, Sarah.
All right, Sarah.
Scarecrow and Mrs. King.
You are correct for 1 point, Scarecrow and Mrs. King.
Good thing you did, because I was wrong.
What did you think?
I don't want to say, because it might come up.
All right, Tara.
Yeah.
You will take us into our score break.
Mm-hmm.
You've got Bobby and Eve. Bobby and Eve.
Well, I'll just try the one I thought the last one was because I don't know the first names of that either. Magruder and Loud. Okay.
Oh, yeah.
This is a 1982 sci-fi police drama on NBC.
Hint.
Starring David and Yancey.
Oh, God. Fuck. I don't remember what this one was called. Yancey.
Anybody? This is Man and
Machine.
Machine.
Oh, no.
Speaking about Dick Wolf properties.
Yeah.
Well. All right. We are almost halfway through. I would like score break, please.
Okay. Sorry, I had to subtract Sarah's steel meal. Tim and I are tied with 6 points each. Sarah D. Bunting is leading with 10.
Ooh, all right. So that means Tim and Tara, you get to share the Gross Earth Equalizer Challenge.
Oh boy.
Good luck.
Thank you.
Which means if you get them right away, you're going to have 1.5 points apiece. And you know I love when we end up with fractional scores.
I do know that.
All right, so what I've done is I had extra questions. So I'm just going to give you a bonus question of this format. You can answer together. And if you get 3 points, you will split them.
Okay.
Here we go. Your alternate name title is Reginald and Bertie. Reginald and Bertie. Just talk amongst yourselves.
I think that's Jeeves and Wooster.
She thinks Jeeves and Wooster.
I trust you.
All right. Jeeves and Wooster, final answer?
Yes.
You are correct, yes.
Woo!
Good job,
Stephen
Tara.
Stephen Fry, Hugh Laurie. Then you're adding 1.5 points apiece. All right, let's get back to it.
Okay.
Sarah D. Bunting, you got Rodriguez and Ed. Rodriguez and Ed. Something and something.
Chico and the Man?
You are correct, 3 points, yes.
Nice.
Nicely done.
Tim, you've got Hansen and Bergstein. Hansen and Bergstein.
I'll take a clue.
This is a 2015 comedy on Netflix.
Oh, God. Give me the last clue.
Starring Jane and Lily.
Yeah.
Name and name. Hansen and Bergstein, comedy Netflix, 2015.
If I
Jane
give you the
Lily.
Actor's last name, do I get a half a point?
Yeah.
Well, I can't. This is going to drive me
that
absolutely
That ruins the
crazy.
Fraction. He'll never allow that.
No, that would actually, I would give you back up to a full point. I would be okay then. Yeah, I'm right. Just thinking of Dave. No, I can't remember it. It's right.
All right, what is it?
I'll steel mill it.
Oh, steel mill from Tara.
Grace and Frankie.
Grace and Frankie.
Thank
good
you.
For 1 point. Yes, Grace and Frankie. Tara.
Yep.
Rick and AJ is the name of this show.
This is Simon and Simon.
This is Simon and Simon, correct.
It is. Yes.
Sarah.
Yeah.
Steiger and JL. JL.
Is this Jake and the Fat Man?
Yes, it is. Nice. It is Jake and the Fat Man. Yes. Nicely done. Joe and
I
William.
I never watched any of these 80s shows, but they're all clattering around in here.
All right, this is question 17.
It's pretty good.
It is for Tim. You've got Finkelstein and Montgomery. Finkelstein and Montgomery.
I'll take a clue.
This is a 1997 sitcom on ABC.
I'll take the last chance.
Starring Jenna and Thomas. What are you thinking, Tim?
I'm thinking that part of my brain that's held on to things from the 80s and 90s is dying in real time.
Sure.
If the listeners can help me the way they helped Dave with that thing, that goop in his eye,
yeah.
I'll give you my email address at the end. Dharma and Greg.
Yeah!
You're correct. 1 point. That was some professional stalling.
Mm-hmm.
Nicely done.
Mm-hmm.
Tara.
Yep.
Your show name is, I'm going to give you two versions of this, and
okay.
We'll explain why after.
Okay.
Hank and Rudy or Hank and Rinty.
Are you going to explain why? At the end.
At the end.
Hank.
So Hank and Rudy, or alternatively, Hank and Rinty.
Okay, hint.
This is a 1988 action adventure on CTV and Family Channel.
Oh, God. What was it called? It hurts. It's not going to help, but give me the last clue anyway.
The actors' first names are Jesse and Rudolf von Holstein III.
I don't know.
This is the Canadian show in which the dog was named Rudy. And then in America, it was known as Rinty. It is Cats and Dog. Cats and Dog.
Mm.
Back to Sarah for question. You've got the show Sanchez and Smith.
Sanchez and Smith. Hint.
Right. A 2013 animated sci-fi sitcom.
Peg and Cat? I don't know.
Voice actor first names. Justin and Justin.
Oh, Justin and Justin.
Just might be the most this person's been named in a pop culture element in a little bit.
I don't know. Josie and the Pussycats.
Steel Mill from Tara.
Rick and Morty.
Rick and Morty is good for 1 point. Yeah.
That bastard. All right.
All right, back to Tim. You've got Rockmore and Kimball. Rockmore and Kimball.
Okay, I'll take a hint.
1996 sitcom on Nickelodeon.
I'll take the actors.
Okay, feeling good about your chances after this hint. Your actors' first names are Kanan and Kel. Don't say I never do anything for you, Tim.
Kanan and Kel.
You are correct. Good for 1 point. Back to Tara. Yep. You've got David Michael and Kenneth Richard. Those are not last names.
Uh-huh.
The name of the show is David and Michael and Kenneth Richard.
Hint.
This is a 1975 action TV show on ABC.
Hint.
They were played by Paul Michael and David.
This is Starsky and Hutch.
This is Starsky and Hutch, yes. Good for one. Back to Sarah. You've got Dorsey and Colbert, or Colbert. I don't know which way you're supposed to pronounce it. Let's assume Colbert. Dorsey and Colbert is your TV show.
Franklin and Bash. Let's try it.
1995 sitcom on Fox.
Ned and Stacy.
Is good for 2 points. I believe that's our first 2-point answer.
I think it is.
Tim, you've got Fred and Lamont. Fred and Lamont.
I'll give you a clue.
This is a 1972 sitcom on NBC. The show is as old as I.
With a beloved theme song, I'll add that.
Mm. Bonus information from Tara.
Oh, I appreciate that you think that that helps. my feeble brain. Give me one more hint.
Your actor's first names, Red and DeMond.
Sanford and Son.
Sanford and Son, good for one.
There you go.
All right, Tara.
Yep.
Jonathan and Jennifer.
Mint.
1979 mystery drama, ABC.
Heart to Heart.
Heart to Heart is good for two. To Sarah, this is your last question. McArdle and Lowell.
This is the one I've been waiting for.
Is this Magruder and Loud?
This is, however, a 1984 sitcom on CBS. McArdle and Lowell.
Kate and Allie?
Kate and Allie, yes, 2 points. Nicely done.
Woo!
Tim, your last question is Stuart and Sally. Stuart and Sally. That's with a U. I know it's going to make a big difference to you.
I actually wrote it down that way, so I'm happy about that. I'll take a hint.
This is a 1976 police procedural on NBC.
Have we done Starsky and Hutch yet?
Yeah, yes. We have.
1976, which network was that again?
Sorry. NBC, the National Broadcasting C.
give me one last hint.
Your actors' first names are Rock and Susan. 1976.
Oh, shit. I'm going to let someone steal this.
All right. Anybody? Know it?
Well, I know it, but I'm not going to officially steal it because I already lost. McMillan and Wife.
McMillan and Wife is your answer here. Yes, McMillan and Wife. No points. Tara, finish us off with Flynn and Fletcher.
Hint.
This is a 2007 animated musical comedy on the Disney Channel.
Is it?
Yes.
How wonderful for it.
Your voice actor first names are Vincent and Thomas, which of course leads you to this answer being the following.
The wrong answer, Sam and Cat. I know that's not right.
This is Phineas and Ferb.
Oh, sure. Oh, sure. God, there's so many still on the board. We could play this again.
There is quite a bit still out there, yeah. All right. Scores, please.
All right. Our final scores are Tim with 10.5, me with 15.5, and Sarah D. Bunting, our victor, with 20.
Wow. All right. Woo. Nicely done, Sarah. I have a tiebreaker here. I am going to give it to everybody. First person to shout out the answer gets a steel mill for future use. Okay. Are we ready?
Yes.
Yes.
Here we go. Your alternate show title is McConnell, eventually. And McConnell, McConnell and McConnell with an asterisk on that first McConnell. Tricky ones, anybody know? We'll give you more info. Doesn't feel like anybody has an answer here, but if you want to guess, go ahead. All right. This is a 1978 sitcom on ABC. McConnell and McConnell.
Is this Joni Loves Chachi?
All right, Tarza.
Why did I say that? I know his name is Arcola.
Your first name actors are Robin and Pam.
Mork and Mindy.
Mork and Mindy is correct.
Good job, Tim.
Mork adopted Mindy's last name when they were adopting a baby or something like that. So he had to take her name for the marriage license or something like that.
Because of woke.
Yeah. All right, nicely done, Tim. But today's game belongs to Sarah.
Sarah.
All right, guys, that is it for another episode of Extra Hot Great. We didn't get so furious about the revenge crime drama Furious. Before going around the dial, it stops at Married at First Sight, the unauthorized Bash Brothers Experience, and the Westies. Tara showed us the depths of human misery, but also funny TV, getting Soldier of Illusion into the canon. We crowned winners and losers of the week, and Sarah was the winner of this week's Namey Game Time. Next up, we're hopping in the time machine for a commercial deep dive and more on Extra Extra Hot Great this Friday. Remember,
we're listening.
I am David T. Cole, and on behalf of Tara Ariano,
the wolf was your brother,
Sarah D. Bunting,
and Little Laughs Like, Yeah, Yeah, That's a Good One,
and Tim Grierson.
Wait, I thought we were going to go to the gym.
Thanks for listening. And we'll see you next time right here on Extra Hot Great.
Gordy re-enters with the twins wrapped in baby swaddles. They each have pacifiers.
Boy, these pacifiers really work. I should get one for my ex-wife.
Gigantic law! And that's the blow. And with that, we fade to commercial. Okay.
All right, you can stop and save
it. So good.
If the world were like a Sleep Number mattress, everything would adapt for your comfort. Your coffee would never get cold. Your flight would always be on time. And your mattress would always respond to you and your unique sleep needs. Sleep Number mattresses are designed to respond to your body and shift with your changing life, helping you fall asleep faster and stay asleep longer. To experience a whole new world of comfort, visit a Sleep Number store or go to sleepnumber.com. Sleep Number, to a good life's sleep.